The other thing that's interesting is that Thomas Jefferson and his wife are third cousins, as was not uncommon in Virginia at this time.
That's like miles away in this period of Virginia. That's nothing.
That's nothing.
My name is Emily Johnson. I'm the curator of arts and history.
Diane Aaron Price, curator of decorative arts and historic interiors.
I'm Catherine Garrett. I am the host of the podcast, Your Most Obedient and Humble Servant, a women's history podcast.
My name is Allison Kiernan. I'm a digital hybrid guide at Monticello. Welcome to In the Course of Human Events, a Monticello podcast. Today, we're going to talk about Thomas Jefferson's wife, Martha Wales Skelton Jefferson. Martha Jefferson is a bit of a mysterious figure. Very few documents in her handwriting survive. Many of our descriptions of her come from second or third-hand sources. And if a portrait of her was ever painted, it hasn't come to light. In his old age, Thomas Jefferson remembered his marriage to Martha Jefferson as, quote, 10 years of uncheckered happiness. But looking at the details of her life, it's a little more complicated than that. Let's start with a quick overview. Martha Wales was born in Virginia in October of 1748. She was married to Thomas Jefferson in 1772 when she was 23 and he was 28. They had six children together, but four of those children died at very young ages. After 10 years of marriage, Martha, too, would pass away at the age of 33. And that's where we're actually going to start, her deathbed.
I used to be a tour guide at Monticello, and one of the ways to get an emotional response out of your tour group is to bring up Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his wife, Martha Wales Skelton Jefferson, and how he responded to her death, because it is one of the moments where Thomas Jefferson is very raw and vulnerable. One of the longest descriptions we have of the death comes from Martha Jefferson Randolph, her daughter. And when she described her father, she said, "As a nurse, no female ever had more tenderness or anxiety. He nursed my poor mother in turn with Aunt Carr and her own sister, sitting up with her and administering her medicines and drink to the last." They said he was never out of her calling.
Shortly before Martha Jefferson passed away, she and Thomas Jefferson must have been sitting near each other, and they copied lines from a book called Tristram Shandy, or The Life and Opinion of Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern. And this one fragment of paper survives. It actually begins with Martha Jefferson. She chooses to pull from this book, quote, "Time wastes too fast. Every letter I trace tells me with what rapidity life follows my pen. They are flying over us like clouds of a windy day, never to return. More everything presses on." And then Thomas Jefferson picks up his own pen and completes the verse, and he says, "And every time I kiss thy hand to bid thee adieu, they are preludes to that eternal separation that we are shortly to make. May God have mercy on us both." This piece of paper, according to their great-granddaughter, was discovered after Thomas Jefferson's death. She said, quote, "in the most secret compartment of a desk, and it had been folded and unfolded so many times."
I personally believe that note was probably kept in a chest of drawers that you'll see in Jefferson's room today. The family I always thought of it as Mrs. Jefferson's bureau, and that might be where the family found the Tristram Shandy love note, which is such a poignant passage of a love story and its ultimate sad ending. It also had her hair in it.
Yes, and it was described as being a luxuriant tinge of auburn.
Speaking of Martha Jefferson's glorious auburn hair, we have a watch key that we recently brought back home. You can see her hair plaited under crystal on one side, and it has her name and life and death dates on the verso. And this is a treasure that we show in Jefferson's bedchamber. And of course, a watch key is something that he would have used every day. So it's interesting to think about the watch key as well as this intimate note, the most personal things that Jefferson kept about his wife.
To think that with the first line of that note, it says, "Time wastes too fast." Jefferson writes shortly after the death of his wife, and he said, "The sun of his life had already passed its meridian. Everything good in his life was over, right? He said, but there was one pleasing expectation, which is this idea that maybe they would meet again in the future. I'm being romantic, but maybe every time he winds his watch, he's getting closer to her.
He's certainly thinking of her. And of course, you wear it on your chain, so it's right next to him every day.
He seems like he was absolutely depressed after Martha's death. Didn't leave the house for 3 weeks. And even Edmund Randolph, a friend, wrote, I ever thought him to rank domestic happiness in the first class of the chief good, but I scarcely supposed that his grief would be so violent as to justify the circulating report of his swooning away whenever he sees his children. After Martha passed away, Thomas Jefferson burned their correspondence. What was saved in the family was a housekeeping notebook and a few other household-related documents. It wasn't uncommon at this time period for people to burn correspondence. It's also happened to the writings between Martha Washington and George Washington, and it's a way to control the memories of a person, particularly people who are in a position like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, where they know that these papers are going to be pored over by people in the future. And for a relationship that was so personal, a lot of times people saw that as this is not to be shared with the public, and that this is something that we'll keep private by destroying it.
It's pretty clear that Martha and Thomas Jefferson had real affection for each other. Jefferson was devastated by her death. But Martha is almost silent in these stories. Who was this woman who inspired her husband to swoon away in grief?
Martha Wales was born in October of 1748 at The Forest, her father's plantation in Charles City, County, Virginia. Her father, John Wales, wasn't part of the Virginia elite in the way that Thomas Jefferson was. It seems as though he was a little bit more of a self-made man. He was a lawyer and a debt collector. He was going around to the richest families in Virginia and asking them to pay their debts on the part of the mercantile companies in England. But through this, he makes enough money that he has a plantation. Jefferson said he was a lawyer of much practice, to which he was introduced more by his great industry, punctuality, and practical readiness than to eminence in the science of his profession. So that's almost a little dig at John Wales, actually. But also, he said he was a most agreeable companion, full of pleasantry and good humor, and welcomed in every society. Martha's mother is Martha Epps.
Who is Gentry?
She is marrying John Wales. She is possibly a little concerned that he's not part of this gentry, and so she has it written in their marriage agreement that if he passes away, she keeps everything that she brings to that marriage, and that goes to her daughters as well.
The Epps family were very well established along the Tidewater, and they were concerned about their daughter. It was the men in the Epps family who said, all right, but this is the way this is going to go down. We're going to protect you. And she didn't live very long.
Yes, Martha's mother passes away tragically very shortly after Martha's born. And then her father ends up marrying three times. So Martha, in her youth, has multiple stepmothers and half-siblings, but she is still promised as the oldest daughter this property and inheritance that she's going to get no matter what. After the death of his third wife, John Wales didn't remarry, but he did continue to have children. He had six children with a woman he enslaved, Elizabeth Hemings. It was one of those things that everybody would probably know about, but not talk about, and certainly not leave written accounts of. So it seems as though Martha would know that these were her half-siblings, and Elizabeth Hemings was a caretaker for her probably longer than any of her stepmothers. But what was that relationship like? We just simply don't know. Martha's first marriage is to Bathurst Skelton, who was the youngest brother of her stepmother's first husband, Reuben Skelton. And so he's technically her step-uncle. So it's one of those Virginia family ties. How old was she when they married?
17, 18?
Even for this period, she's pretty young.
Yeah. So they marry and they settle. They get their own plantation, Elk Hill Plantation in Goochland County.
They had a son named John, but less than 2 years after their wedding, Bathurst Skelton died suddenly. We're not sure exactly how, but it seems like it may have been in an accident. So Martha Wales Skelton became a widow just before her 20th birthday. One of the interesting things, if you read the will of Bathurst Skelton, there's an addendum, and it says, his wife, Martha, has the full use of his horses and phaeton. This is highly unusual for a young woman to have almost like her own car at 18 years old. So she's able to drive herself wherever she would like. She could go into Williamsburg. She could go to the shops.
Skelton was very young when he died. Is it curious for somebody to have a will that young?
When I read that will, I got the sense that he knew he was dying.
Yes.
Something happened. He was going.
You're about to meet your maker. You should make a will. Yeah. Uh-huh. And Martha said, don't forget the phaeton.
That's what it sounds like to me. We know that Jefferson took on John Wales as a legal client in 1768 before Bathurst died. So some people have suggested that maybe he met Martha while she was still married to Bathurst.
The first time that he actually brings up a documented visit to the forest is on October 6th, 1770. And it seems that he stopped there because he needed the work of a blacksmith. Maybe his horse is cast a shoe. I like to think that maybe while he's waiting, he would have been invited inside and maybe he would have encountered the daughters of John Wales. We don't know.
The courtship, she was a musical person and Jefferson was a musical person. And one of the famous stories has it that her two other suitors showed up at the same time to try to pay a visit to the widow Skelton, and they walked in, heard her playing music with Thomas Jefferson, just looked at each other, put their hats back on, and went back outside. We do have letters where Jefferson is writing about buying a clavichord. He says he wants the workmanship of the whole to be very handsome and worthy of the acceptance of a lady for whom I intend it. And so he's purchasing her gifts, and he's also clearly referencing the fact that they both appreciate music.
Jefferson writes about his love for Martha, and he said, in every scheme of happiness, she is placed at the foreground of the picture. Take that away and there's no picture for me. She was described as being of lithe, exquisite figure. She walked, rode, and danced with admirable grace and uncommon skill. And then they said that her eyes were hazel. She had a graceful, queen-like carriage. So she's described as being a beautiful woman.
When Thomas Jefferson is courting her, she has a son, and she's going to get married and start over again. And then as they're planning the wedding, her son dies, and they have to postpone the wedding for her to grieve.
Jefferson and Martha Skelton marry on January 1st, 1772. So that gave about 6 months for her to grieve. They get married at the forest, and when they traveled up to Monticello, the story is, and again, this is published much later on in the 1850s, but there's 3 feet of snow on the ground. It's still dark outside, and they're on horseback. Martha Jefferson, who's been down in the most populated part of Virginia, she's riding through this landscape that is devoid of any discernible landmarks. There are very few buildings. There are very few people living out here. And she's confronted by an 18 by 18 foot brick structure, standing alone on a hilltop, probably with some other wooden buildings around, but it's a construction site. Surprise, honey, we're home.
Her father was well-to-do. She grew up in a nice plantation. She already had her own plantation that she was planning on living in with Bathurst. She knows the best of the best. And then she moves into a one-room brick house. And the family legend has it that, oh, she just took it on the chin and they opened up a bottle of port or something and they had a great time. And maybe that's true, but maybe that's something that was exaggerated in later years.
Yeah, I'm sure he was explaining and gesturing and pointing of what was to come. I looked at Jefferson's memorandum book and they went all that way and they only stayed a week or 10 days. I can see Martha saying, all right, I've seen it. We're going back to my father's home, or we're going to go and stay with my sister. And that's essentially what happened. They were often traveling. One other thing I noticed, which struck me as very meaningful, is that they came back in the height of summer for the birth of their first child. Martha Jefferson Randolph was born in this two-story brick building.
So their daughter, Martha Jefferson, was born on September 27th, 1772, almost exactly 9 months from when they got married.
If you look up the Washington Jefferson snowstorm, it's exactly 9 months before that. All joking aside, think about Martha Jefferson, now almost 24 years old, giving birth in a one-room house on a mountaintop in the middle of nowhere. Who's there to help her? This is where we start to get a glimpse into the connections between Martha Jefferson and the enslaved women at Monticello.
Someone who's really important is Ursula Granger, who's a pastry cook and somebody that Martha knew from her life in the Tidewater. Martha asks Thomas Jefferson to purchase Ursula. And then I can only imagine that Ursula Granger says, you also need to buy my husband and my son, because Jefferson does. And in so doing, Ursula Granger affects the reuniting of her family under this new owner, even though it entails a move away from their existing family structures and their kinship networks. But it's Ursula Granger who's called upon as a wet nurse, because Martha Jefferson, it seems like maybe her pregnancies were difficult. She was having trouble with milk. And so Ursula Granger, who also had a child at that time, was called upon to help feed Martha Jefferson, who would become Martha Jefferson Randolph.
I pulled up the quote because that also struck me, that she really wants Jefferson to purchase Ursula Granger. And Jefferson says, Mrs. Jefferson was very desirous to get a favorite housewoman of the name of Ursula. I attended the sale, therefore, and purchased her and two young boys, her sons. Meriwether Skelton, who attended the sale and purchased largely, run me up to £210, an exorbitant price, as the woman was old and the boys infants. I like pulling these direct quotes when we talk about the way Thomas Jefferson talks about slaves, because it is so fiscal and dehumanizing. But I think it does say a lot that she was like, no, we need Ursula at the house and you will pay £210 to get Ursula here.
There's a lot of men at Monticello at this point because it's under construction. It's full of workmen, both hired and enslaved. But it's also a woman's world of people like Ursula Granger. So Martha Jefferson is coming into this landscape of enslaved women, and her daughter is being born also into this landscape of enslaved women. And these connections will last throughout all of these women's lifetimes.
1 year later, in 1773, Martha's father, John Wales, passed away, and the Jeffersons inherited 11,000 acres of land and 135 enslaved men, women, and children. This is roughly when members of the Hemings family began to come to Monticello en masse, including Elizabeth Hemings and some of her children. Martha Jefferson's father, John Wales, had fathered six of these children: Robert, James, Thenia, Critta, Peter, and Sally Hemings. These were Martha Jefferson's half-siblings. In 1774, Martha Jefferson gave birth to a daughter named Jane, who would die at the age of one. In 1777, 3 years after that, she had an unnamed son who lived only 2 weeks. In 1778, she gave birth to Mary, who the family called Polly and later Mariah, who would go on to live into adulthood. Meanwhile, during these same years, Thomas Jefferson attended the Continental Congress, drafted the Declaration of Independence, and was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. He was often away from Monticello, leaving Martha Jefferson to manage the plantation and care for their family.
The other important document that you can mine over and over again is this account book of Martha's. She has lists of all of Thomas Jefferson's wardrobe in one given year.
We have his clothes, we have her clothes, we have their daughter's clothes.
Right. How many sheets they had.
How many geese they ate. How many gallons of beer she brewed 8 months pregnant.
One of my favorite sources about Martha Wales Skelton Jefferson is the life of Isaac Jefferson of Petersburg, Virginia. It's Ursula's son, Isaac, talking about Martha, saying that she would come out with a cookery book in her hand and read out of it to Isaac's mother how to make cakes, tarts, and so on. And I think that is an interesting description that shows what the plantation mistress role was, which is she is managing the household, but a lot of it is telling other people what to do on her behalf.
Martha Jefferson is sitting in the kitchen telling these enslaved women who've been cooking since they were children and are incredibly highly trained and have cooked under any number of circumstances and situations and environmental challenges, but yet it's the plantation manager who is sitting, again, sitting, telling people what to do. Plantation management. It's a way to quantify a woman's value in how good of a manager she is. And I feel like in the family, Martha Jefferson gets held up as being a good manager.
There's so few descriptions of people's personalities and women of this time period. You only get the vaguest descriptions. So it is exciting that we do have a quote about her from Ellen, who is Jefferson's granddaughter, but she must have gotten it from her mother. But she says, "My grandmother Jefferson had a vivacity of temper, which might sometimes border on tartness, but which, in her intercourse with her husband, was completely subdued by her exceeding affection for him. She did say, this little asperity, however, sometimes showed itself to her children, and of course more to my mother, her oldest child, than to the others who were much younger." So it seems like there is a little bit of friction between Martha Jefferson Randolph and her mother, Martha Wales Skelton Jefferson. But even Ellen immediately backpedals after writing this and says, but of course she was wonderful and perfect and an angel.
Makes me reflect on the times when my husband has gone away for a long time. Jefferson, as the political scene heats up and he's off in Philadelphia for weeks at a time, Martha Jefferson has a lot of responsibility and a lot of worries. And that's often when mothers feel stressed and are not their perfect selves. And I could imagine what that might have been like in that scenario where you're not so patient or you need your children to do what you ask them to do.
I believe there's a letter from 1776 when Jefferson is up in Philadelphia and they want him to stay on longer. But Martha Jefferson is not very well at the time and he decides to return to Virginia rather than staying in Philadelphia.
I've got a quote from a letter on July 29th. So the famous July of 1776, later in that month, he writes to Richard Henry Lee, "For God's sake, for your country's sake, and for my sake, come. I receive by every post such accounts of the state of Mrs. Jefferson's health that it will be impossible for me to disappoint her expectation of seeing me at the time I have promised." He's like, "I've got to get back immediately." And he uses such dramatic language. It does seem as though there's a period of that time where they're married at Monticello as things are being built, where she is just pregnant and losing pregnancies and losing children for years, which if you just see it all lined up, it does look absolutely brutal.
We believe that Thomas and Martha Jefferson could have moved into the house probably around 1775. So this is almost 3 years in the quote-unquote honeymoon cottage, the 18 by 18 foot space. And then when they move into Monticello I, the original eight-room structure, it's unfinished. As late as the 1790s, there's a description of the walls being unplastered. So basically a construction site that she never saw finished in any real way, shape, or form. It adds to the sense of this life, the adventurous parts of it, but also the really challenging parts and the things that might raise your blood pressure and cause you to be a little snippy at times as you're going around probably a drafty, unfinished place.
Uncheckered happiness.
Uncheckered happiness.
Yeah. We don't. Yeah.
Next on the Jefferson's happy adventure was the American Revolution, fought from 1775 to 1781. During the later years of the war, from 1779 to 1781, Thomas Jefferson served as the governor of Virginia, and the Jeffersons were living in the capital city of Richmond. It was during this time that Martha Jefferson became involved in a campaign to raise money for the war effort.
The Continental Army was always underfunded. They didn't have enough food, clothing, pay. And up in Philadelphia, there's a campaign that's started by upper-class women who are spouses of politically active people. And a woman named Esther Reed writes a lengthy broadside called The Sentiments of American Women. It's a rousing call to battle for women, what women can do on the home front. And their goal is to raise money. Martha Washington, wife of General Washington, asks Mrs. Jefferson, as First Lady of Virginia, Jefferson's governor at this point, to launch this campaign. And four letters that she wrote in regards to this lady's campaign survive, all on the same date. I think it's August 8, 1780. She's about 6 months pregnant. It's got to be hot and steamy there, and she's at the writing table taking care of this assignment.
How did the broadsides work?
These broadsides, clearly Martha Washington must have included a sheaf of them to Mrs. Jefferson in Richmond. And then in these letters, I don't know how many she sent to each recipient, but the instructions are there'll be sermons preached on a specific Sunday. We would like you to bring your donations, and then also instructions like, don't give us your small change, round up. So make the math easy, which I personally appreciate. And then there would be one woman called the treasuress in each area, and the treasuress would collect this money, and that's how the campaign was to work. And so off these letters go, and funds start to come in. Women are really giving of themselves personally. They're sending their wedding rings, diamond earrings. And it was successful. For example, this bundle of specie and guineas and pistarenes that came from Alexandria, the total was $75,812. And what I love about this letter that I found is that this treasuress from Alexandria, she's very specific that Mrs. Jefferson is to receive this money. This was not to go to Governor Jefferson. This was to go to Mrs. Jefferson in Richmond. So during the war, Martha Jefferson's experience was one of action. She was a leader. And we have evidence that's really opening a door to the whole story of women's history during the Revolution, at least for elite women.
It's a story about these female connections, friendships and relationships, cousins and sisters. And so all of these women are taking this network and activating it.
A few months after she sent these fundraising letters, in November of 1780, Martha Jefferson gave birth to another daughter named Lucy Elizabeth. In December of that year, the British would invade Virginia, making it a war zone. Baby Lucy died in the spring of 1781. Then in June, Martha would face what would have likely been one of the most frightening moments of her life, with her two young daughters, Martha, age 9, and Mary, age 3.
The war really starts to heat up in Virginia. Richmond has become a dangerous place, and the government decides to leave Richmond. While armies are moving around this landscape, Jefferson and Mrs. Jefferson and their children and probably a small group of enslaved people come back to Monticello. This is the spring of 1781. And then there's the famous story of Jack Jewett, who hears that the British are planning a raid to capture Jefferson, the sitting governor of Virginia. Jewett then rides over towards Monticello to warn Jefferson. Jefferson gets word, and with the help of many people in the enslaved community, probably members of the Hemings family, probably members of the Granger family, they pack Martha Jefferson and the children into a wagon and they flee Monticello. Jefferson rides off, and according to some of the stories, about 10 minutes later, British armies under Colonel Tarleton arrive at Monticello, and they're looking for Jefferson, but they're also looking for silver. And the story is that the British meet Martin Hemings, and Martin Hemings is described as having a very powerful personality, somewhat intimidating. And the British soldier asks Martin Hemings where the silver is, and Martin Hemings basically says, "You're not going to find it." And the British soldier, according to the story, takes out a gun and points it at Martin Hemings and says, "Tell me where it is." And Martin Hemings says, "Do your worst." The British do not find the family silver, which members of the enslaved community had collected and, according to the stories, had hid under a porch. But of course, what's also happening is that Martha Jefferson is in a carriage with very young children, running from the British who are actively trying to imprison her husband. They're separated. She doesn't know when or if she'll see him again. She doesn't know when or if she will escape. The fear that must have been experienced in these hours and days while you are running away from an invading army. It's remarkable to think about, and it's really the one time where the war touches us here at Monticello. They traveled down to Poplar Forest, which was just remote enough to keep them safe. This is all happening in June of 1781, and so this group of British soldiers decide to stop chasing Thomas Jefferson and get down to some business in the rest of Virginia, which culminates in the battle at Yorktown in October of 1781. And of course, that's the final major battle of the war.
The Jeffersons were back at Monticello in May of 1782 when Martha Jefferson gave birth to a daughter that would again be named Lucy Elizabeth. This child would live only until the age of two before dying from the whooping cough. Martha Jefferson herself, however, was struggling, it appears, to recover from the birth of this child. She died on September 6th, 1782. Now let's return to the deathbed scene where we started.
The other fascinating reference to Martha Jefferson's death is actually from Edmund Bacon. Edmund Bacon was an overseer at Monticello from about 1806 until 1822. He has his recollections of Monticello published in about 1862. He's getting his information from his wife, who's getting her information from members of the enslaved community. He describes that Betty Brown, Sally Hemings, Critta Hemings, Elizabeth Hemings, Nance Hemings, and Ursula Granger, all enslaved women, were present with Martha Jefferson at her deathbed, and that they told his wife about their experiences. He says that she's giving Jefferson lots of instructions, which from what we know about her personality, that kind of tracks. But he says when she came to the children, she wept and could not speak for some time. Finally, she told him she could not die happy if she thought her children were ever to have a stepmother brought in over them. Okay. From what we can tell, she had pretty good experiences with stepmothers. But again, thinking about property, especially because she had girls, gendered property ownership is something to be deeply thought about in the 18th century. If Thomas Jefferson had remarried and had a son who survived, then his daughters, who become Martha Jefferson Randolph and Mariah Jefferson Epps, would have had very little claim to Jefferson's property. They would have had whatever was designated for them as perhaps a dowry or a marriage portion. But they would not have had assets in their own name. And she felt like she had to protect her daughter's interests going into the future in the way that her interests had been protected.
And then the other women who are in this room are, in a lot of cases, members of the Hemings family, enslaved women. And so to get a promise from Jefferson that he will never have a stepmother for the children, that has serious implications for their lives as well, which I think would come immediately to mind to Elizabeth Hemings, because after Martha stops having stepmothers is when Elizabeth Hemings starts having children with John Wales. It seems as though by making a promise to never remarry, the first thing they would think is that he's going to start having children with enslaved women. That's going to be the first thing that comes to mind for them in that situation.
Absolutely. This idea of things happening again and again over generations is another very powerful aspect of this story.
Enslaved women had no legal right to their bodies. Sally Hemings bore children fathered by her owner, like her mother and countless other enslaved women. By law, children born to enslaved women would inherit their mother's status as being enslaved, regardless of who their father was or their complexion. You can read more about Sally Hemings, her family, and her remarkable life and legacy on our website.
In his autobiography, it's a partial autobiography, which was written in 1821. So we are almost 40 years from her death when Jefferson is writing this. He calls their marriage 10 years of uncheckered happiness. I'm never going to say it was a smooth 10 years. I'm never going to say it was an easy 10 years. But I do think that Jefferson was very happy with his choice of a wife. And I can only hope that Martha Jefferson, despite the challenges and the fears and the struggles that she withstood, also felt some of that joy.
It's a shame that she died so young that she didn't get to see the new United States, but her brief life was also very significant and interesting. If you really dig in and you take the history seriously, there are sources you can use. There are things like writing desks and housekeeping notebooks that you can use to flesh out the story, and it really expands our understanding of history.
Something that we can think about is we know that Thomas Jefferson, after his wife died, designs her gravestone. Years of grave hunters, curiosity seekers in the 19th century would chip off pieces of Jefferson's grave, but also the graves of his family members.
In 1839, a visitor account published in the newspaper discusses the stone, and it was what they call a table stone, so it was a big flat stone, and he says it was right next to the obelisk. And then he says on the neighboring obelisk are the two daughters.
And didn't he say that it was in really bad, it was in poor, really
point,
poor condition?
At this point, Martha Jefferson's stone was still there, but it was broken.
And I believe it was the 1920s when the current obelisk that we have today in the Jefferson graveyard was reinstalled. It's interesting that they didn't choose to renew the graves of the wife and the daughters. And so I think one of the things about women's history, it's who gets remembered and what context do they get remembered. We often think of the wives of presidents as a way to understand the man they were married to. But she was obviously, as we discussed today, remarkable in her own right and deserves her place in the historical record.
It's been a fabulous conversation. I want to thank everybody who gathered for this conversation. And we want to thank you for listening. It's always a pleasure to bring you along with us as we talk about our research and we talk about the fascinating people who lived at Monticello and who continue to touch us and shape us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun to talk to you.
This has been great. It's been thrilling.
As always, I have an epiphany when I speak with this group. And thank you so much for being included. I always enjoy it.